Welcome to Ilani Talks, a podcast focused on self-care, love, and all that comes with it. I'm your host, Ilani Salcedo. I'm a mental and emotional health writer in the wellness space, and this is just an extension in voice format, of course, that I do on ilanisalcedo.com. With mental health being a topic that's heavily centered in my writing, this episode was one I was excited to record. Guest Jafina Khan Salim is a professional who brings light to how much our own mental health is vital to look after. We also speak about generational trauma, an experience that oftentimes is pushed upon children of immigrant parents and is carried throughout lifetimes without many of us noticing it. Our cultures are important in defining us of our values and customs, but there's a flip side that can be threatening to our well-being when stigmas are put in place that make us feel shame in seeking the help that we need. Another part of our conversation also focuses on technology and its effect on our minds and moods. As we all know, screen time is part of our daily lives, but do we all actually think of how much it affects us? Listen in and get perspectives that might be different than your own, but still offers a safe place to expand your mind. Welcome, Jafina, today to the Ilani Talks episode that we'll be speaking about.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm really excited too. I'm really excited for everything that we're going to speak about. But before we begin with the main questions, I have two default questions that I usually ask my guests, and they are, what do you do and what do you want to be known for?
Sure. So I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I am the founder of my group practice, Breakthrough Mental Health Counseling, which is located in Huntington on Long Island. I work with adolescents, teens, young adults who may be struggling with anything from anxiety, depression, life transitions, trauma, tech addiction is like my newer area of specialization. And then I have other clinicians that specialize in different areas.
And what do you want to be known for?
I think to put it simple, I would want to be known for change. We have so much going on in the world right now, and that can only be fixed with change, right? Because we see history really just repeating itself.
Yeah.
So if I can be a part of that, I want to be there. I want to be known for change.
Yeah, I think with the work that you do, you're making a lot of changes. So
that's the goal.
Yeah. All right, so let's dive in into the topics. Before speaking about you as the founder and the services of Breakthrough Mental Health Counseling, what in your personal life led you to become a licensed mental health counselor? Are there any external influences, or was it more of just a feeling within you?
So I think from the age of adolescence, I was watching Law & Order SVU, which is still one of my top shows. I am dedicated and I watch it every season from beginning to end. And if any of you watch it, Dr. Wong was one of what they called the shrink, right? Mm-hmm. The quote unquote shrink. His role always amazed me because I truly think that's where the possibility of getting into this field began for me at least. Because of what he really did. The majority of my family's in business, so I definitely stepped outside of the norm when it came to career choice. And after high school, I earned a license in cosmetology, and I worked in a hair salon while completing my undergrad degree in psychology. As most people know, the salon is a cheaper version of therapy.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I was fully exposed to what it would be like for people to tell me their struggles and their problems, even if it was something small like, I can't stand my mother-in-law, I can't stand my boyfriend's sister, whatever it was. It was also always something that they were going through that they felt the need to spill the beans in the chair. So that was like my first real exposure to people like talking to me, mm-hmm. even if it was on a smaller scale of things.
Yeah. And were there any hurdles along the way that felt like too much, or that the goals you had in mind couldn't be met when it comes to your field and what it took you to get here?
I think we all go through some kind of imposter syndrome. In any situation that we find ourselves in that requires hard work and dedication to reach the bigger goal. So I'd be lying if I said no. So definitely, yes, there were moments I questioned if I would be able to help people and help them make positive changes that they were expecting to make.
Mm-hmm.
But I I think the program that I did my master's in at St. John's University, Queens, really prepared me, like,
that's great,
extremely well, with the practicums and the internships. And I've had an experience in a hospital psych setting and outpatient settings. So I think after doing those things over and over again, you really find it to be second nature after that.
Yeah, because you're preparing yourself and like you're exercising those muscles that you need for for the work.
Yeah, and definitely the imposter syndrome is definitely more in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then once you just do it over and over again, I think confidence builds. And then new goals come and then new imposter syndrome comes up again. So I think this is something that reoccurs when we seek out a new adventure.
Yeah. And that's a great way to put it, because that's so true. No matter what you're doing, no matter like what industry you're in, you're always going to find yourself in that position. And I know for my own self, with everything I do, I've definitely struggled with that.
Yeah. And but then it's like once you do it and you get a taste of it, it's like a drug, right? You get that adrenaline rush.
Exactly.
And it feels so good. And you're like, I want to do more of it. I want to do more of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between knowing your passion and then just not feeling it and saying, I don't know if this is right for me or not. But I definitely feel the adrenaline, especially when I have a patient that does well and is ready for discharge. That's that rush for me.
Yeah, definitely. And fast forwarding to 2017, when you began your journey with Breakthrough Mental Health Counseling, how does it feel being a founder and offering the services you do for adolescents, teenagers, and adults?
It feels absolutely amazing. I think autonomy in conjunction with your passion, like I was just mentioning, or doing what you love, is such a good feeling.
Yeah.
I worked in so many clinical settings before where the numbers just mattered, right? So how many of your clients are you seeing a week? Are you keeping up with your treatment plans and your paperwork and all that stuff, right? Insurance was looking for our numbers, so they had to report to that. So after starting Breakthrough, I had the opportunity to really sit with clients and meet them where they're at, spend an extra 10 minutes with them if they needed that, without the overhead pressure and politics.
Yeah. And that kind of just like ruins your mission if this is your passion work, you know? It just gets in the way of getting to the root of what you actually want to do versus all the politics that go into it.
And then, you know, private practice always also like allowed me to really find my niche or my specialization. I feel like when I was in the clinic, it was just like a go, 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 again, trying to meet those numbers. But now I get to take a step back and say, okay, who do I really want to work with? What do I really want to focus on? What's the bigger issues in the world that I want to be a part of? And how can I get extra certifications or training in those areas to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. And even with that, you could definitely tell it's your passion and wanting to go that extra step for the people that you have that support system for.
Exactly. And when I started Breakthrough, it was just myself. I was an individual just in private practice. And then it slowly, more recently, began to grow into a group practice where I tried to build clinicians into the practice that also had that passion and also those specializations. So by that, like the clinicians on staff right now are what I like to believe a good mix. We want to meet people to serve as many different ethnicities and cultures. And I think I choose clinicians around that specifically because there is a certain community that sees mental health as a stigma. But if they see someone from their culture or from their background that's providing the services, they are more likely to come have it or give it a try.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like if they could do it, that I could do it because we could relate and we're somewhere kind of the same. Or, you know, like you're able to... I don't know, I can't find the word, but you're able to relate more.
Right?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that commonality of even just something as simple as language, right? So if you have a Spanish-speaking patient and a Spanish-speaking clinician, they already feel so much more comfortable because
Absolutely.
They feel like, okay, like this is my quote-unquote my people. I feel comfortable. They know what my culture is. They know what our food is like, and we can have small talk around that. And that's how you build rapport. And then once the rapport is there, that's where the work starts and you really see progress.
Yeah, definitely. And with that, mental health, clarity, stability, in other words, that can mean the same or similar, are important to have or at least aim for in life. As you provide a space for your clients to feel more secure about their mental health, what are the stressors you see most that cause any level of difficulty? And I know that this could vary in terms of your clients and individuals and what they're going through and what they actually go to you mm-hmm. for, but is there anything that you see within a wide range of people, demographics, that kind of have that commonality?
Yeah, definitely. So anxiety and depression symptoms are typically underlying factors in most diagnoses. However, more recently, I've labeled technology as a major, major stressor that is causing difficulty for people and their ability to cope and understand what they may be going through. Because being constantly stimulated or stimulating our brains every 5 minutes, it doesn't give our brains an opportunity to relax or simply just think about what's going on. Being constantly plugged in, it takes away from us even feeling, right? And some people say they use it as distraction, which can be good and can be bad because it can be distracting you from the feelings that you need to be feeling. And so I do see technology as one of the more newer underlying factors to everything else that's just been around for a longer period of time. It exacerbates the anxiety, exacerbates the depression. And I see it around all ages, from adolescents to adults. Yep.
And it's ever developing too. So, I mean, hopefully it doesn't get worse, but sometimes it feels like it could.
I feel like we're in for a long ride. I think that show on Netflix, Black Mirror, that really... Mm. It really depicts social media into what I think it's going to become, unfortunately. Social media, technology in general, this idea of constantly being plugged in and having to feel like we have to be plugged in. FOMO is a real thing.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
It does affect people on different levels. So I think it's going to be around, and I think it's not going to be that helpful. Technology is a great thing, but in moderation, of course.
Of course. And everything in moderation, right?
Yeah.
And I think also with you speaking about technology, sometimes we're not able to feel what we're really feeling, or actually like just sit down and think for a second, because not only are we relying on our devices, but also we're being pushed other people's ideas and valuing ourselves. And we don't even notice valuing ourselves onto that. Which is so dangerous.
I completely agree with you. Because we compare, right? So there's a lot of comparing happening. Like, for me to look good, right? Mm-hmm. What that ideal body has to look like, right? And then you have the other movement where you have the plus size models who are like, no, you can feel good in this body too.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel like is so slept on. I think they have a voice and they have a strong voice. But the popular, right, the majority wants to see that skinny, quote unquote, healthy, right, what they think is healthy in themselves. And that's where we compare ourselves to what we should look like instead of just being comfortable with our body. Because I think that's the first step to any kind of diet to begin with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Being
comfortable and being able to accept that I may not be able to have arms or abs like she does, but maybe I can have a two-pack versus a six, right? And then that's still progress. And maybe the two-pack looks better on me than a six-pack would, really, because of my body shape or the type of body that I do have. But we try to fit ourselves into these. It's like fitting a triangle into a circle block, mm-hmm. right? We try to often do that to ourselves, and we get frustrated when we can't meet those goals. It's simply because it's just not for us.
Yeah, we have to be realistic about what is for us.
Exactly.
So I want to shift the conversation to speaking about mental health and cultural influence. And I know you briefly touched upon that, but you come from an Indo-Caribbean community and understand that within the Caribbean culture, there's a level of stigma when it comes to a person's emotional state and seeking help when a safe space is needed to work through difficulties, trauma, and other factors that affect a person negatively. Can you speak about the importance of awareness and where values lie that can clash easily because of generational trauma mixed in with cultural pressures, which in turn can have an impact on the well-being of a person?
Yes. I think this is so important, especially the world that we're living in today.
Yeah.
And I hope not to offend anyone, but it's just more of just my knowledge and where I see the connections to be. So just from my personal experience, both of my parents were born and raised in Guyana, which is in South America. My siblings and I are first generation Americans, but raised with the traditions and the culture of what it means to be Guyanese. With that comes the values that my parents hold from the environment, the traditions, and the cultures that they grew up in. And so during that time, what's thought to be a third world country, you can imagine what they've seen and experienced while growing up there. Mm-hmm. And so when we automatically think of or hear third world country, we think they went through like financial hardship, right? Yeah. But it's so much more than that. There's political wars that were experienced, race wars that took place, and anxiety around being safe automatically festers off of those things, right? With human beings. So if we feel like our safety is in danger, the anxiety is going to kick it up a notch. And these are the generational traumas, I think, that many first generation Americans experience from the immigrant parents. I think it's also difficult to understand why and how to hold space when it wasn't our trauma as first generation Americans.
Yeah, that's right? The most difficult part.
Yeah, we're like, Mom, why are you, or Dad, why are you acting like that? Like, let me go out with my friends after 5, or when the street lights come on, I could still be out, right?
Yeah.
But so often, and that leads to the conflict, right? So a lot of times you'll hear immigrant parents and their children come into conflict on how to be raised the quote unquote right way, right? But it's a struggle for the child because they have no evidence or reason that they've experienced in their own lives that warrants them to behave or to live in fear like their parents have.
Yeah.
It's such a tricky thing to understand, but I think once people just take the time to sit and listen to their children and meet them where they're at, it can make such a big difference. And a communication, right? So helping your children understand what happened back home, but don't imply that the entire world is unsafe. Again, generational trauma. Then then our children begin to live with that fear or that stigma that I have to protect myself against or from this person of this religion or from this person of this race because my parents went through this race war that happened with this kind of race or this religion, right? And but we don't even understand it ourselves because it wasn't us. We were the ones that were there. I think how immigrant parents trying to understand what their child is going through here, where you've brought us in America, is a big part of that. You know, and what is a child or a teen or an adolescent growing up in America, what are our expectations? Because it's definitely not the same as back home, right? Western culture is very much different. And immigrant parents often expect their children to be what they weren't, right? Because now you have the opportunities, that pressure. They've given us these opportunities. So, you know, I think you should become that lawyer, that doctor,
or that engineer. Well, I don't really like that.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're like, well, I really like art.
Mm-hmm.
Or I really like talking to people, right? So like I mentioned before, my family is strictly business, accounting, finance. That they went down that career path. Many of my cousins they're all in that business world. So for me, it was a little different. And I think when my parents even heard me speak about this career, I had to do a lot of explanation as to what it is, what I'm going to be doing, who I'm going to be helping. So, you know, I think autonomy is huge. I think autonomy is important. It's a part of human nature. And when we feel like our autonomy is being taken or challenged, we automatically fight back. And so that's the struggle again between the immigrant parent and the first generation American child. I know it's like a loaded question. I'm giving a lot of information because it's a loaded question. But let me know if I missed any parts of the question.
Well, maybe not only with focusing on that generational trauma that parents give their children or give this pressure that I know for sure they don't try to do that on purpose, but because, like you say, back at home it was a certain way, how could they not act the way they do? But also it's really hard for someone who hasn't experienced the same things, which are the children, to feel the same way or meet them when they're at, because in your brain you can't process it. You're like, okay, yeah, I get what you went through, but why are you so scared? Or, you know, like, why are you so nervous about this? Like, why can't I just do this?
Right.
So, and there's that factor.
And look, from the parent's perspective or the parent's side, they're coming from a protective part of, mm-hmm. of what they're feeling. They're not, I think a lot of the difficulty here is the parents being able to let that fear go and saying, no, I experienced this. This is real. If it happened to my parents, or my parents, or someone died from it, right? So even then, witnessing that trauma, it makes it so much more real that they can't let it go.
Yeah, and it keeps replaying, essentially.
And it just keeps replaying, and I feel like if we allow our so this is another part of it, if the awareness around mental health. Mental health is usually a stigma in families, right? Mm-hmm. If our problems are our problems, we keep them in our house. No one needs to know about them. If something's wrong, or if you're showing something, you call me. Let's talk to our friends and our family. It comes with judgment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but when we seek therapy, it's a different ball game. You know, something that I tell my patients right off the bat is, there's no judgment here. And I always say I've heard it all, because I truly have. I feel like nothing can shock me anymore. It really has to come from like left field to shock me. And then the other part of that is, who am I to judge? If, you know, your struggles may be a little different from the person for you, right? The main thing is that struggles are different, but we all feel it's still an emotion. We still all have the same emotion. So my job is not to judge you on that, but it's just to help you get through it. I think once immigrant families can begin to understand that I'm on your team as a family.
Yeah. Most importantly, yeah.
I'm here to help you and your child get through this. I'm not here to report you, or, you know, a lot of immigrants are afraid to come to therapy because of immigration status.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually here to protect you, right? And help you get through that fear of ICE or whatever it is, and give you resources.
Yeah, and which are so needed, you know? Like,
yeah,
back home, they live such a different life. Coming here to give their family moving forward a better life, they still have so much to work through within themselves that it could be so scary. But like you say, you're there to help them out. You're on their team. Yeah. But that's sometimes really difficult to make them understand,
yeah,
as well, I'm sure.
I think, just to wrap that question up, but at the another part of all this is truly just allowing yourself to feel, and the parents letting the children to feel, right? So I've had clients who are teens or even young adults, and they say, you know, I've been wanting to come to therapy, but when I tell my mom I feel sad, they're like, oh, just pray on it. Or, you're not feeling sad. It's just a phase. You'll get over it. And then it goes on for months and months. So sit with your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes crying is seen as being weak, but we have to feel what we're feeling. And we simply can't change what we don't acknowledge.
Yeah. With this episode hopefully being a message to those who need it most, what's your advice for individuals that don't have the necessary support to overcome their challenges? I know you kind of just answered that without the question, but is there anything else that you would add on to that?
Just one word, read. Book, books are so powerful. They're an escape.
Yeah.
They provide perspective and insight. And so many people are already writing about what they've gone through, their experiences. If they're struggling from depression or anxiety or a breakup, or going to therapy. So reading is such an old tradition, but why not just keep it going if it works, right? There's so many self-help books for any possible obstacle you may be going through. And I like to say library cards are free, so that means books are free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Use it if you're able to, you know?
Now we have the resources for like the audiobooks. So I tell patients that don't have time to sit and read to just put it on in the car. I often recommend the app called Libby, L-I-B-B-Y. It's basically your library, your hometown library on an app. It's free as well. You just have to have a library card again. And most books are on there in audio form. So while you're driving to work or driving to school, it's a great way to just maybe change it up a bit from the radio that we, music that we're listening to every day.
Yeah. Yeah, reading is so important. I mean, I'm an avid reader, so I'm a little biased, but no, it's very helpful. Like you say, you're able to get so many different perspectives and topics that you might want to dive more into. You get a book that you're able to read and get more educated on it and just bring more knowledge to yourself and just use it as something. Instead of using your phone as something, as an escape, use a book.
Exactly. Oh, my God. You're doing good. You're doing good.
Thanks.
What you're doing is a great alternative podcast. There's so many podcasts on mindset and mental health and growing a business or getting through a breakup. There's a podcast for everything you can think of. So I'm pretty sure if, you know, I'm struggling with how to create my own business, there's probably a podcast out there that will help me do that.
Yeah, and lots to choose from. So if you don't like one, you could go to the next one and see what really fits with you.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
While everything we've spoken about so far are ongoing topics we can easily continue with, one of the other significant contributors to stressors is technology, as we've already spoken. As a certified tech addiction clinician, can you speak about what led you to focus on this and how this day and age, the negative effects of technology keep rising? And I know we've spoken a little bit about that, but anything else you'd like to add, I would love to hear.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, I've been seeing screen time. So like any screen time, whether that's iPad, phone, video games, as a huge underlying factor of mental illness, and just an overall inability to function in a healthy way. So I decided to explore if there was even any kind of certification in this area. Due to the increase of anxiety and depression that I was seeing in many of my patients. And then before I could actually find some kind of training, I started to kind of test my theory a little bit because I had noticed that there was a pattern of, I'm on my phone all the time or I can't fall asleep. And the question I would ask is, well, what helps you to fall asleep? And they'd say, well, I just go be on my phone. I just scroll on my phone until I fell asleep. So then I slowly began to try something new outside of the traditional CBT coping strategies and focus around just decreasing screen time. So what I eventually saw was a decrease in symptoms because they were no longer on their phones or their screens in general doing things that was just empty, right? Those things don't truly make us happy. I mean, does anyone ever come off of their phone and they're like, oh my God, that was so much fun. So exciting.
I've actually never heard that. Right? So I doubt it. Yeah.
Yeah. It when we think about it, it doesn't make us happy. So eventually, you know, after the symptoms decrease and they're replacing that screen time with things that they find joy in, they found time and energy to use traditional coping strategies. So it's like I put the traditional coping strategies on the back burner, introduce a decrease in the screen time, and then bring them back in after. And the other idea around that is many people think social media is social, but it's very isolating.
Oh, yeah.
So once we remove that, we welcome relationships and interaction and quality time.
And those are like the essence of just having a healthier and balanced life. Like without that, as much as people rely on technology or their phones or whatever, they don't see how much they're missing out because they're focused on these devices, focused on these things that you think are doing something good for you, but in essence, they're really not.
And then I think back, like you and I are probably very close in age, and I think back to like our childhood, I remember playing outside.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember writing notes in class to my friends and spending time with my cousins and on the weekends, like being at other people's houses and really like having a good time with that. Mm-hmm. But I think today is very different because yes, maybe we do go over to someone else's house, but what are we doing there?
We're all on our phones.
Yeah. Try to put a few teenagers or adolescents in a room and take their phones away and see how they react. Very difficult for them.
Yeah. They can't find that, I guess, conversation aspect that we grew up with without the phones and the devices.
Something as simple as eye contact as well is not there. Or difficult to get in touch with.
And with that, I believe children are our future and will always mirror what they've been taught and have experienced. How can parents and adults set a better example for the growing generation in terms of technology and setting boundaries that don't necessarily take it away completely, but will allow for healthy development and coexistence with it?
Yeah, so this is a great question because we always get the parents that bring the children in and want us to quote unquote fix them. Yeah. And oftentimes, I know you and I have spoken about this a little bit before, but oftentimes it's usually a family dynamic issue that needs to be aided here. And parents need to learn that all things are good, like I said before, in moderation. So I like to give the example of, would you let your child play basketball from sunup to sundown? Probably not, right? Because they would physically be exhausted, their joints would hurt, their limbs would be sore. It's causing physical pain on the child, right? So why are we letting our children be on their phones, iPads, video games, computers from sunup to sundown, right? We're inducing mental exhaustion and pain without even knowing it. Mm-hmm. So again, moderation is key. And so parents ask, well, how do I do that? And I just say, get to know your child. Have a certain time in the evening where you put your phone away, or even in the mornings, you know, phones don't come out until you're actually in school and you hand it off right before you get out of the car. Go for a walk, watch a funny show, make food together. So many things to do. And parents, like for the parents, think back to when you were a kid. What was fun? You know, bring some of that stuff out because chances are you need little material to do it. And the kids will probably love it. You know, kids, when you take their phones and things like that away, initially they get upset. If they go through similar to a withdrawal phase, they get angry, they get upset, they cry, they kick, whatever it might be. But once they get over that little hump and they begin to welcome and see these new things are actually very rewarding emotionally, it's hard to, and you offer them the phone back again, it's almost hard for them to accept it because now they have a comparison. Like, well, I don't really feel good doing the phone all the time, but I really did like painting outside or playing basketball with my cousins or my friends.
And how sad would it be, like, as you said, get to know your child, like, years down the line, I didn't get to know my child or we don't have that connection or, you know, whatever it is that they're missing because we were on our devices all the time. And not only the children, but like as parents and as adults who are taking care of them, we need to also be that example as well. Like you can't be yelling at them for having a device and then you're sitting there on the same one, you know, for hours.
Exactly. And so I tell parents, if you're expecting the child to unplug from 6 p.m. until the next morning, the entire family should. Right? Because it's like smoking in front of the kid and saying, you know, this stuff is really bad for you. You shouldn't do it. right? Smoking cigarettes and then telling them it's horrible for you. It's kind of silly.
Yeah.
What really stinks is that the generation that was the beginning of when technology really became dependent, like people were really depending on them, there were like the trial generation, yeah, right? Now we see the effects on that generation and those parents, and they're almost regretful. But now we know more about what technology does on your mental health and as well as your physical health. So if we know more, why not prevent, right? Prevention is key.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned before, for Ilani Talks, I've spoken to you about my goals in not only centering conversations about self-care and love, but also addressing those topics in all walks of life, even if it's not defined in these words. How do you understand these focuses to be incredibly important to have no matter who you are?
I tell my patients, until you love yourself, no one else will, right? The only person we can truly depend on 100% is us.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't we giving ourselves the first priority? It's vital. We can't function in a world where we don't appreciate, love, and value who we are. And then when that begins to happen, the people and the relationships we form around us becomes a reflection of that. The relationships with people we have are of value because they value us. And I always say that to others, because when we sit and we really think about it, it makes sense. We teach people how to treat us.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, say it again. We teach people how to treat us.
Yeah.
So if you allow someone to continue to take advantage of your time and always show up late to meetings, you now have taught that person what? That your time is of no value. When we value ourselves, we then seek relationships that value us back.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes that healthy cycle of self-love.
Yeah.
We just feel good overall. The energy is good. It's positive. And those positive people in our lives are the ones that pushes us for our goals. So it just works out. Loving yourself is a great foundational base to anything that you want to accomplish. And sleep. I always say that. Sleep.
And that, definitely.
And, yeah, sleep. You need sleep.
If you're not sleeping, you're not going to be in a good mood. Like, it changes everything.
Yeah. Sleep is our form of plugging our charger in.
Yeah. Rejuvenating.
Exactly.
Yeah. In closing our time together today, is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience that might have been missed? And what are a few key points you'd like anyone to take away from our discussion?
I think the message that I want to close with is, more recently, I've been hearing a lot of people question, does therapy work? Will it work for me? I've been wanting to try it. And then they do all the research, they find someone that they like,
mm-hmm,
but they don't make that phone call, right? And I always tell people, just make the phone call. Hear the voice on the other end.
Yeah.
And then if that feels good, make the appointment. And you just have to go to one appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, us therapists, we don't lock you in our offices. You can leave.
Yeah, it's a choice.
You don't have to come back. But give yourself the opportunity to do something for you. Because therapy is a form of self-care. And I think the idea of self-care has just become so trendy or mainstream within the last couple of years that people are like, oh, I've been doing my nails, I've been doing my hair, I've been getting a massage, right? I've been going out to dinner. I just don't feel like the self-care even works, right? They question it.
Yeah.
But don't do self-care because everyone else is doing it. And don't do the self-care that everyone else is doing. So self-care shows up in different ways for everyone else. So sleeping is self-care. Saying no to people is self-care. Longer showers, exercise, eating your favorite fast food, setting boundaries. So those aren't things we often hear when we think of self-care. So you really have to, again, tap into what works for you. It's like the example I gave of the six-pack and the two-pack,
yeah,
right? The body shape. We have to use what works for us, what fits for us and our lifestyle. And then my last takeaway is unplug. Out of the week, pick a day where you completely don't touch that phone. And people usually feel a huge difference, a huge sense of relief, less anxiety. People don't even know that they're anxious over the phone until they do this little experiment. I tell the majority of my patients to challenge themselves once a week without the phone or any screen time.
It's incredible the changes that it does. Like, I even have done that for myself, and it's I'm a little bit more aware of things that like trigger me to be more anxious, and I'm just like super hyper aware of things. But even myself, there'll be moments where I'm like, why am I feeling like this? Okay, let me not use my screen or my phone as much. And there's definitely a difference that you feel right away.
Yeah, it's what we're exposing our eyes and our brains to, right?
Yeah.
Our subconscious is a powerful thing. So we see things that we may not have or we can't do, and we get hard on ourselves, right? But if we can take that time to work towards being able to do those things, or have that kind of vacation or that adventure, or eat at that restaurant, right? If we work towards that goal,
mm-hmm.
And don't put that time and energy into the phone, you don't have to go through that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Know yourself, right?
Know yourself, know what you need, know what makes you happy, know what makes you feel energized and positive. And that's just something that I think we have to really teach ourselves on how to do. And again, generational, it needs to come from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
So teach your daughters that they can do and be anything that they want.
Yeah.
Teach your sons that they don't have to make X amount of money to be extremely happy.
Yeah.
Teach your sons that household can be 50-50 providers, so you don't have to take all the stress.
Mm-hmm.
But also teach your daughters that she can have a full-time job and be a mother. Right? So wherever they find joy and love, there are mothers that feel like they have to give up their career when they have a child. And then what's that then? Resentment.
Yeah.
What comes with resentment? Anger. Anger is a symptom of depression.
Yeah. And then it just spirals from there. If they're not able to catch it and be like, what do I need and what makes me happy? What am I able to actually do with what I have?
Right. So it's really just getting back to us and focusing on what we need, what we want.
Yeah. Perfectly put.
And if no one wants to help you along that journey, then forget them.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Shafina, for sharing everything that we spoke about today. I really hope that anyone and everyone could take away something from this, because I think there are very valuable points that you speak about and what we've been able to speak about today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Of course. No matter who you are, what you're going through, the country you live in, and your wellness habits, I hope you've been able to take something away from this episode. It was an honor to sit down with a mental health counselor and founder of her own private practice, because making changes for the world in this way, I believe, is important and extremely valuable to the livelihood of so many different people she's able to offer her services to. If you've been thinking of going to therapy, I hope the message you get from our conversation is that it's okay even when you're not sure about it, and even if it's not about that, I do want this to have the capacity of being a starting point for a more comfortable space to speak about your well-being and the changes that are needed. We live in a world where everything seems to be a trend for self-care, but when we take a step back, we can truly see how much deeper it is for our whole self, not just for moments. Thanks with all my heart for listening to Mental Health, Generational Trauma, and Technology with Shafina Khan Salim. This episode is the 10th one and wraps up season 1 of Ilani Talks, but I'll be back soon for the second season, including more amazing guests and episodes where I share more of myself. It's been such an amazing ride so far, and I'm excited for the next chapter. Please kindly rate this podcast, leave a comment, follow or subscribe, share with whom you see fit, and stay tuned for future episodes. Until the next one, with all my love, Ilani.